Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the humanitarian crisis in the north of Iraq and the US intervention with airstrikes from the aircraft carrier, the George Bush, in the Gulf and airdrops to besieged Christians and Yazidis fleeing the murderous IS fighters. Robert Baer, who ran the CIA's operations in the Kurdish north of Iraq starting in 1991, joins us to discuss the disconnect that the Obama administration is still trying to stand up an inclusive government in Baghdad to govern a country that is no longer a country, while the stable Kurdish area in the north, which is under threat from IS, is being denied weapons and money it is owed from the central government, as well as not being able to sell its oil. Then we will speak with Shibli Talhami, who served on the Iraq Study Group and is the author of The World Through Arab Eyes, Arab Public Opinion, and The Reshaping of the Middle East. We will discuss the shifting focus of regimes in the Middle East away from blaming Israel and the US for the region's problems as the radical group IS makes stunning territorial gains that are frightening regimes in the area which previously supported Sunni radicals. We will also discuss the apparent silence of mainstream Muslim scholars, clerics, and leaders in condemning the barbaric sectarian slaughter and rape underway as IS fighters terrorize Christian, Yazidi, and Shiite minorities they have captured. Then finally, Christopher Clark, Professor of History at Cambridge University in the UK and author of The Sleepwalkers, How Europe Went to War in 1914, joins us to discuss ceremonies in Europe commemorating the 100th anniversary of the beginning of World War I and the comparisons between the entangling alliances that dragged the big powers into war back then to today's geopolitical landscape, where the crisis in Ukraine and disputes over small islands in the northeastern Pacific could drag the US, China and Russia into a wider war. And joining us now is Robert Baer, who is a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle Eastern countries, including Iraq and Lebanon. Robert Baer is now an intelligence analyst at CNN, and he's also the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife True Life Spy Story. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
Thanks, Ian.
So describe what happened. After the first Gulf War, there was a humanitarian blowback in the north because Kurds fled into the northern region, and then the U.S. Was involved in a huge humanitarian airlift in 1991. Not dissimilar on a greater scale, I think, to what's happening now. So describe what it was like when you were essentially sent up to the Kurdish north to head up the CIA's operations, in effect, between the Iraq wars back in, I guess it was 1991, right?
Well, I was sent up there to, number one, is work with the Kurds, and number two, find a way to overthrow Saddam. Mm-hmm. By that point, there had been a decision made in the White House that this was in 1991, that he had to go, and it was approved by Congress. It wasn't very serious, but we worked up with the Kurds, and what was important for us, that there were daily flights out of Incirlik, Turkey. It provided air cover. It was more symbolic than anything, just to warn Saddam that if you dare come back up in the Kurdish areas, you will bomb you. That worked fine until 1996 when Saddam moved into Erbil, arrested a bunch of deserters, dissidents, and what have you, but then quickly left. But Erbil is what I'm trying to say here is a vulnerable target to a well-organized military force, which ISIS is close to. When they took the border area last week, they attacked it with our armored Humvees. With 14.5 NA aircraft guns on the top. And the Kurds were armed with small arms, Kalashnikovs, only 6 magazines apiece. They were quickly overrun. Now, how did we get here is the question, and that is State Department and the administration refused to let the Kurds buy arms these last couple of years, in spite of this threat. They kept on telling the Kurds, Barzani in particular, go to Baghdad, get their arms from there. Of course, Maliki, prime minister, wanted nothing to do with it. Not only that, Maliki has stopped giving their oil money. I think he owes the Kurds some like $6 billion, as I understand. So Maliki has been starving the Kurds. They're a weakened force. Good fighters, but a weakened force. So for ISIS to overrun these positions, lightly defended, I guess it didn't come as much a surprise to a lot of people, you know, closely watching it. The problem is now we continue this fiction, and it's a total fiction that Iraq is a country. It's not a country. It disappeared in 2003 when, over the course of 2 weeks, we bombed the Iraqi army into oblivion. That effectively broke up Iraq for forever. It's three countries. We live the fiction that it's a single country run by this Shia prime minister. It's never going to be. So right now we are in the position of either trying to bomb ISIS into submission, which I don't think these people will be, myself, my reading of them, or arm the Kurds. And we're going to see what happens. I can't predict what Washington's going to do.
But at this point, Washington hasn't given up on the fiction, and nor, for example, have the French. The French foreign minister is now in Baghdad talking about standing up a unity government. And I mean, if there's ever anybody that would replace Maliki in any case, he would be handpicked by the Iranians. So why is it that we are continuing this waste of time, the same talking points now for years on end, at the same time not helping the Kurds who are under threat? And the arrangement that you had with Incirlik, the big Turkish Air Force base, that doesn't exist anymore, does it? I mean, the U.S. Is bombing.
Well, we don't have the pieces to change the tide of battle in Iraq. I just don't believe we do. I mean, you've got to move aircraft carriers. We've got a military in particular saying, hey, enough is enough. You know, we've done this for 12 years. We've paid in blood. We're tired. We want to come home. We're obviously not going to put boots on the ground in Iraq. I think the American people would revolt about that, and never mind that it would require the draft, which I just don't see happening. It's the lawyers at State Department who keep this fiction. Politically, I guess Obama doesn't want to be the guy to say, I lost Iraq. Of course, he didn't lose Iraq. Iraq was lost in April 2003 when we destroyed the Iraqi army. But no one is actually facing that fact that it's over, it's broken. And, you know, so I don't see why we're going to come to a rational decision at this point, with that kind of memory loss. I just don't see it.
Well, but the memory loss preceded the war itself, apparently, because the only person in the entire Bush administration that presented anything that resembled a dissenting view, or at least an alternative view to the consensus that they were going to liberate Iraq and it would be a cakewalk, was apparently Colin Powell, who, from what we understand, said to Bush, use the pottery barn analogy, if you break it, you own it. And that's the part that's extraordinary, that we refuse to own it. And we still refuse to own it now. And we still refuse to own the consequences, particularly the humanitarian consequences of hundreds of thousands of Iraqis who've died and now are continuing to die. So that's the part
It wasn't just Powell. Anybody with knew Iraq understood this.
Right.
Whether the British or the Americans, I dealt with them a lot in those days, and our position at the CIA was, Iraqi hands is, all right, you can decapitate the regime, but you can't change the nature of Iraq, which is a country controlled by a military. We may want a democracy, but that wasn't within our ability to create that. We knew that. So we always said, let's decapitate it, get rid of Saddam, his two sons, and let some other general on a white horse come in. And we were shut down by the neocons. And anybody who knew Iraq pre-invasion was removed from the CIA. The people who actually ran including the interrogation and Iraqi operations were all out of Latin America. They'd never set foot in the Middle East.
But they'd had a lot of experience torturing people.
Yeah, exactly. And they were brought in, like Jose Rodriguez knew nothing about the director of operations, knew nothing about Iraq. any of these countries in the Middle East, and they were all brought in because they were compliant. I mean, the people at the White House knew more than they did, so they could just say, this is the way it's going to be. We know what we're doing. But any Arabist in Iraqi operations was removed with any decision-making. They're all gone. When Bremer got to Baghdad, he gave an order to keep Arabists out of his daily morning meetings. I know this from people who were there.
So if you,
anybody who speaks the language of talk to Iraqis, I do not want them in my meetings. So we went in there with blind ignorance, perfectly happy to impose what we thought would be the perfect Iraq. And, of course, this is what we get.
So now that ISIS has the Mosul Dam, which my understanding is it's a huge accident waiting to happen. It was very badly constructed. So the foundations were never properly set. So apparently you have to constantly pour grout in to stop the water from seeping underneath the dam and literally bursting it wide open and sending a 65-foot tidal wave through Mosul, which is only 30 miles downriver, and on all the way down to Baghdad and all the way, I guess, into the Gulf. My understanding is that Saddam built this dam in part as a weapon to be used against the Shia if he decided he needed to flood them and literally wash them all the way to the Gulf.
Well, Ian, you're exactly right. In the mid-90s, he completed this, and he built it in a way that would flood the Shia south or flood any corridor of invasion from the south, an American invasion. He went out to his engineers, and we had very good intelligence on this. Trust me, it was very, very good. And he said, look, we want to be able to close the locks off into the Sunni areas. I don't know how much that Mosul that included, but and then force all the water south, and in particular, the Shia learnings of center like Najaf and Karbala. And so there's the Iranians or the Americans come from the south, open up the dam. It doesn't need to be blown up. You just let the water out, and it's full, by the way, as I understand. And then you can wash million Shia out into the Gulf, which of course. We could describe this dam as a weapon of mass destruction. It looks that way to me.
So, but do we know whether IS are who now have captured this dam, whether they are keeping the engineers at work, doing this constant grouting? Do we have any knowledge of whether? They seem to be all about capturing territory, beheading heretics, taking jihad brides. But I'm not sure they're big on engineering.
I would doubt they are. You know, the best intelligence we're getting out of this, my secondary sources are people in Kurdistan and some people in Jordan talking to the Sunni. But, you know, it's not reliable. And, they are talking about letting the water out of the dam, that ISIS is capable of doing this. I would doubt that they can get the material to keep this dam going. But that's, this would be on my expertise, what takes a dam to break open. But, it's certainly a fear that ISIS would open the dam, whether they would or not. It's just like a fear. I know that law enforcement here is their ISIS members' sympathizers in the United States. Now, what they're planning or not planning, I have no idea. But the fact is they are here. Some of them come across the Mexican border. Establish themselves. Are they here because they're fleeing the conflict, or are they here to do harm? I don't know.
But in terms of what can be done and what the U.S. might have in terms of military plans, even with a military that's sick to death of Iraq, nevertheless, presumably the U.S. has some kind of a plan. At this point, if they're just conducting a few, pinpointed airstrikes on artillery pieces, etc., and doing the humanitarian airdrops to help the Yazidis out, who I think are by and large now escaping the Peshmerga, moving in to rescue them.
Ian, every problem in the Middle East is to be taken care of by local proxies. You want to do something about Libya, you get the Egyptian army to move in. In fact, there are talks right now between Algeria and Egypt for that possibility. I don't know how far advanced they are, but if Benghazi gets much worse and a source of instability in Egypt, the Egyptian army will move in. At what point, I don't know. If you want to do something about Iraq, you have to consider the unthinkable, and that is bringing in Iranian forces. I wrote a book about this a couple of years ago, said, if things continue to go bad, this is an option we're going to have to look at. And that's an option I would look at today. I know it's complete anathema, but don't forget that Iran has said zip about bombing of Gaza, because this has turned into such a vicious sectarian conflict that Iran has, in word at least, abandoned Hamas and the Palestinians. You just look at there's not a word. Right. Same way with Saudi Arabia and the Emirates. They're almost silently cheering on Israel. And this virus of militant jihadism is going to only be destroyed when there's an alliance between the Sunni establishment and Iran and the military dictatorships. I know this doesn't look like democracy, and it isn't. But this really, truly needs to be crushed. I mean, they are killing Yazidis, these so-called devil worshippers, because for no other reason than they're not people of the book, as they'd say. And they can define who's people of the book. And they'd probably exclude you and me, for sure. Normally Christians are sort of untouched in Islam, but their narrow definition of a true believer is getting narrowed by the day. So that means what they believe is legitimately executing people is pretty, large number of people. So I don't see any way, but this movement has to be crushed. But U.S. soldiers doing it, that'd just be an act of insanity.
Well, that's, I think, not likely to happen, and the president's made that pretty clear. So what about the Kurds? I mean, we haven't given them any weapons for the longest time. Again, that's hard to understand why we cling to Maliki and they get shortchanged, the Kurds. Are they the much-vaunted Peshmerga? Could they be sufficient if they were properly armed to take... At least,
I think so. I've fought with them. I think they're pretty good. I mean, they're good soldiers. They never stop. And you bring the reservists out. They don't have any ammunition. Give them ammunition, heavy weapons, and armor. And I think they could carve out an enclave that would be protected from the crazies. That's a start. But it would also move them closer to independence. We'd also have to let them pay for this by exporting oil. Right now, we're seizing Kurdish oil off the coast of Texas. You'd have to let them sell that oil through the pipeline to Turkey, and we're in effect, a de facto dividing up of Iraq. But I think in the Middle East, it's time we start dealing fact. We decided not to in 2003 deal in fact. But we're long over that. Trying to live our dreams in the Middle East. And it's, the Ottoman Empire is still breaking up in a very nasty way, and we're not going to get it to break up in the way we want, and so we better let it break up in the way it will. There's no point in opposing it. And we should further that and tampen down the violence everywhere we can.
Well, but meanwhile, IS are selling their captured oil on the black market, so it doesn't make any sense for the Kurds not to be able to get the revenues from the oil that they already have.
In a way, we're not embargoing IS oil; we're embargoing Kurdish oil. It's crazy.
Right.
I mean, I realize it's a whole other mechanism that we can't understand or get to how they're selling it, but they've been selling it in Hasakeh and eastern Syria. For a long time. There's a market for this stuff. They put it in trucks and drive it into Turkey, usually through Iraq. But yeah, you're absolutely right. But that's the State Department doesn't want to deal in fact. There's too many lawyers at the State Department.
Well, Obama's getting a lot of criticism as a result. He had to sit down with Tom Friedman of the New York Times just to sort of try and get on.
Is that the low point of his administration?
Well, that he had to sort of basically say, I'm not asleep at the switch. And he's clearly a very intelligent guy.
He's not asleep at the switch. He ended up with no face cards in his hand. He had a war in Afghanistan that couldn't be won. He had a war in Iraq that couldn't be won. Now everybody's saying, hey, you didn't win those wars.
Right.
Bush had 8 years to win in Afghanistan. He didn't. He certainly didn't win in Iraq when Bush decided to pull out or was forced to pull out by the Iraqis. And in the whole, you know, awakening in Anbar province was all sort of a propaganda. You know, it was all a lie that this was the way it worked, that we defeated the terrorists.
Right. It was just all it did was got Bush and Cheney's irons out of the fire and gave them an exit so that they were totally trapped. And I think that's why Petraeus became such a hero and got rewarded, not for winning the war, but for their political extrication of this ridiculous regime that was so blind going in and to this day is blind. And that's the part of the discourse that's so strange, is that people are blaming Obama for not somehow, staying in there.
It's the same thing as denying global warming, that it's man-made, you know. If people don't want to deal with what appears to be settled science or settled reality in the Middle East, there's nothing you can say or show them that's going to change their minds.
Well, and of course we are in an election year, so there's nothing you do to stop political spin. But just going forward in the last minute here, Robert Baird, do you think that you were saying earlier that you don't think there's any, that whatever we are planning on doing, whatever it is not going to be sufficient to defeat IS?
I think what's going to happen is our bombing of the Islamic State is going to give it more credibility. Because if it can continue to carry on attacks, guerrilla attacks, and it do things, it's going to say, look, we're at war with the United States and we're beating it. Of course, they're not really at war because it's just completely half-hearted what we're doing. So I think that ISIS, said is probably saying, "Not keep bombing us." You can't hit anything with a plane going 900 miles an hour. You know, and when you're flying across Iraq, you're across it in 2 minutes. You know, so you know the air campaign is not going to destroy this group. It will, I would imagine, things go according to plan, it will bolster it. What's going to happen is this group's going to explode when they can't rule. But how long will that take before that's apparent? I don't know.
Well, Robert Baird, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Baird, who's a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle Eastern countries, including Iraq and Lebanon. He is now an intelligence analyst at CNN, and he's also the author of 3 New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife True Life Spy Story. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about how the radical Islamic State is frightening regimes in the neighborhood. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Shibli Talhami, who is the Anwar Sadat Professor of Peace and Development at the University of Maryland, College Park. He has served as advisor to the U.S. mission to the UN and more recently served on the Iraq Study Group as a member of the Strategic Environment Working Group. He is currently a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, a founding member of the Board of Directors of Education for Employment, and previously served on the Board of Directors of Human Rights Watch and the United States Institute for Peace. He is the author of The Stakes, America in the Middle East, and his latest book is The World Through Arab Eyes, Arab Public Opinion and the Reshaping of the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Shibli Talhami.
My pleasure to be with you.
And give us a sense of how the Arab world is responding to what's happening in the north of Iraq. A woman in the north, an Iraqi Christian, on the BBC World Service, asked rhetorically, amongst wailing and you know, hideous and the hideous conditions that she was escaping from, she pleads, "What century are we in?" And then before the Iraqi Parliament, a Yazidi woman, a Kurdish MP, says, "Mr. Speaker, our women have been taken as slaves and sold in the slave market." How is the broad Arab world, if there's such a thing, responding to this? We thought Al-Qaeda was bad, but IS is a whole new descent into hell.
And undoubtedly, I think what we're seeing is really the worst we have seen in the contemporary Middle East. It's extraordinary. The degree of intolerance is just amazing, even by any standards. I wouldn't say they're you know, any worse than Al Qaeda. Remember, Al Qaeda, you know, was being hosted by the Taliban, who are about equally intolerant in that political order. But there are some differences that are important now to think about, because that's why, in some ways, the region is somewhat more focused on it. The first thing is that when we faced Al Qaeda threat, obviously, even prior to 9/11, we knew they were mounting attacks on the U.S. It was specifically targeting the U.S., mostly targeting the U.S. And the region wasn't really focused on what they stood for, what their ideologies were. They were remote from the Arab world, from the Middle East. They were in Afghanistan. They weren't the ones who were running the country in any case. And they were going against the U.S. At a time when there was a lot of anger with American foreign policy. And so people focused less on who they were and what they were seeking, and more about the anger with American foreign policy. We saw that in the polls, because throughout that whole period, I was asking people about their attitudes toward a group like Al-Qaeda. We had fewer than 6%, in some cases fewer than 4%, who agreed with their agenda of having a puritanical Islamic State like the Taliban. So people were, in a way, looking the other way about what they stood for, in large part because of the anger with American foreign policy. Here you see something completely different, because what you see here is the Islamic State trying to run parts of the Arab world and changing the lives of people in ways that were offensive to the overwhelming majority, not just to the minorities, obviously especially to the minorities, the Yazidis, the Christians, and others, and the Shia, by the way, as well, but even to secular Sunnis who don't agree with them, which is, you know, a huge, arguably the majority, who can't stand them. So that degree of intoleration is unacceptable. So at some level, it's generating real, genuine fear in the region, where the ISIS is seen as a threat to them less than it is seen as a threat to the U.S. or Israel, the traditional enemies. And so in that sense, you're finding it is completely reshuffling the strategic deck in the Middle East. At the same time, there are also unfortunate aspects. I think we should see far more criticism of ISIS and what's doing in Iraq and Syria from mainstream clerics in any of the major Muslim countries. And because what they're doing is totally unacceptable by contemporary standards of most Muslims, and we need to see far more critique of them. We're beginning to see a little bit of that, but we need to see even more.
And Shibli Talhami, would the fact that the Iranian regime is basically cut Hamas loose, they're not supporting them in this current war in Gaza with Israel. It seems to me that's a kind of glaring change, is it not? Would that be to do with what you're talking about, that these countries in the Middle East now are just fed up with this
well,
form of extremism?
Well, I don't think so. I think, remember, there are a variety of things here that people differentiate between different groups. I think the attitude toward ISIS is profoundly different from the attitude toward Hamas, even by the Shia. Remember, Hezbollah, Iran's main ally, is still a key provider to Hamas in terms of, I mean, frankly, much of the rocket technology and possibly many of the rockets are coming essentially from Iran, Syria, and Hezbollah. And they continue probably to come even in the middle of that war in a clandestine fashion. So I wouldn't say that Iran has withdrawn its support from Hamas. They see Hamas more as a nationalist movement connected to the Palestine question and less as a jihadist movement connected to ISIS. In fact, they fear that if you have the kind of anarchy that might emerge in Gaza and you have the disintegration or defeat or weakening of Hamas, in fact, you could end up with groups that are far worse, like ISIS. So they haven't really changed their position. But in Iraq and Syria, what has happened is, of course, ISIS had been the enemy of the Iranians anyway, both ideologically, religiously, and politically. And obviously the Iranians are backing the Iraqi regime that is Shia-dominated and the Iraqi military that is Shia-dominated. And the same is true. They're standing with the Assad regime against ISIS and an opposition group. That's not new. But what is new is that many of the Sunni states, particularly Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates and Qatar, that started by supporting opposition to Assad, but may not have been very effective at differentiating between extraordinarily extremist groups like ISIS and moderate opposition that everybody really wanted to support, that in the process of that wave of support that we're providing, a lot of that aid inadvertently or sometimes by design went to these groups. And now as they see them to be a threat to them, they're really having a tough time figuring out how to manage it. And that's what the U.S. is trying to do. The U.S. is essentially, if you've read President Obama's interview with Tom Friedman, New York Times, essentially administration hope is that fear that emerged could be captured into a broader alliance to deal with ISIS as long as the Iraqi government finds a way to be broader so as to allow Sunnis within Iraq and Sunnis in the neighboring states to actually come together in a coalition against them. But they feel frightened by them at the same time that they also don't like Iran and they don't like to see the current Iraqi government dominate as it is.
So you mentioned the condition of the Iraq government being more inclusive, and I keep hearing that refrain, and frankly, I'm mystified as to why the U.S. is still clinging to this fiction that somehow Iraq is still a country, and if Maliki is replaced, he'd be replaced by somebody handpicked by Iraq. Meanwhile, the U.S. is not stepping up to help the Kurds. They haven't supplied them with any military equipment for years and years, in deference to the central government, this dysfunctional government in Baghdad. And the Kurds are not even able to sell their oil again. So why are State Department lawyers still living in the past? And why are we so, whistling in the dark here, trying to prop up Baghdad when we should be propping up Erbil?
Well, obviously policy is changing. There are reports that more aid is going to the Kurds, and clearly even the action that the president undertook in terms of both the humanitarian supplies and the limited military action against ISIS were connected with the threat to Erbil in the Kurdish sector. So they see that as essentially a bottom line or red line that they're trying to defend. So I think policy is evolving. But I want to just give you a couple of answers that are broader, and I think the complexity in which the Obama administration were operating. Number one, obviously, they didn't want to be drawn into a new war. That's clear. That's one of the president's worries, that somehow he will have a slippery slope toward another war, which he doesn't want, the American people don't want. But he said something really interesting in his interview with Tom Friedman. It's a bit revealing, and he said, look, we're not going to be partisans in internal conflict. Essentially, we're not going to take the side of a government and be its army if it is a partisan party that is not inclusive. And that idea, and so therefore for Iraq, he doesn't want the U.S. to become Iraq's air force. Doesn't want the U.S. to become the Kurds' air force. He doesn't want the U.S. to become the Shia air force for sure. And so in some ways, it tells you a little bit about how he's trying to manage this thing, even in Egypt, between the Brotherhood and the military in Syria and in Iraq. It gives you a little bit of a window into his thinking about this inclusivity. The instinct is right. The problem is that at some point you're going to have to make decisions, particularly when there are threats to national security. It is obvious that whatever the reasons for the rise of ISIS, and I think that there are multiple reasons dating back to the Afghan War, but ultimately the biggest reason is the 2003 Iraq War itself that led to the disintegration of the state and allowed groups like that to emerge. But nonetheless, there's no question that the administration was surprised by the speed of the takeover of ISIS. I mean, you know, remember when we knew that they were operating, you know, here and there, and the administration was dealing with them. But a lot of the experts were saying, look at the numbers. There's no way they can actually spread because there's such a limited number of people that you can't have that many forces to occupy and keep occupying. At some point, they're going to just fizzle. The Shia are going to come together and so forth. And none of that happened. And so it's been, and I have to tell you that for me as an analyst, I still find it an extraordinary puzzle how ISIS expanded so quickly and so fast to the point that some of the Sunnis in Iraq, and I was talking to some of them who were very close to it, particularly in Mosul, who were thinking that they're even exaggerating their own power, up until the time that you see that they're actually taking over cities and they're actually killing people and they're actually executing innocent people, whether they're Yazidis or Christians or Shia or anybody else that they don't like. So I think everybody's been taken by surprise. I don't think anybody has come up with a very good explanation of how they have come to be so effective.
Well, they are so effective now that my understanding is that the Mosul Dam that they now control, which supplies most of the electricity and water for Iraq, is itself a weapon of mass destruction. That Saddam had engineered the locks to be able to flood the Shia south if he felt he needed to. And in order to maintain that, it's an accident waiting to happen. You have to continually pour grout in because the dam foundations are not properly settled, and that if you don't maintain it on a daily basis, the whole thing's likely to explode and send a 65-foot wall of water through Mosul, which is 30 miles downriver and all the way down to Baghdad and into the Gulf. So the question now is, and of course it eventually radical organizations like Al-Qaeda and IS prove themselves incapable of governance because nobody wants to live in the 12th century anymore. But up until then, they can do a lot of damage, can't they?
There's no question. I'm not confident enough technically to tell you about the consequences of their control of the dam. And this is something you leave to people who really follow details of those issues. But there's no question that they have not only the dam, but they've also controlled some oil resources, and in some ways that's going to help fund them and extend their life and make it hard to dislodge them as we move forward. Yes, I mean, it's a real danger, and you look at what's happening. We're talking about Iraq, but look at what's happening in Syria. There were stories yesterday about stoning women for adultery, but there was also in the same coverage of those stories where they were applying these laws as they understand them to communities that where these laws have become foreign to them, that they're facing some resistance. And at some point, obviously, that could happen. But in the meanwhile, you know, it's a major military strategic threat to the region. I think people are figuring that out. They don't see them essentially as a threat to outsiders. They see them as a threat to their own communities. But because of the rule of, you know, the enemy of my enemy that has fueled so many unusual bedfellows over the years, you know, in terms of dealing with, oh, I don't like the Iranians, therefore I'm going to support this party, and I don't like the U.S., therefore I'm going to support this party. That has been an operational principle of many of the alliances and coalitions, the attitudes in the region. They still are, because the region is still very complicated, and there's a perception of many different threats by different people, whether it's Iraqis or Saudis or Syrians or Egyptians. But there is no question in my mind that something profoundly happened over the past few months in the way people see ISIS in the Middle East as a threat to them, not just as a threat to their enemies. And they would rather, you know, the rule that the enemy of my enemy is my friend has changed in the case of ISIS, where you have the enemy of my enemy is even a worse enemy.
Well, just in closing, obviously, again, you feel like with IS blowing up Jonah's tomb and the fact that the Yazidis are on this mountaintop, Mount Sinjar, which is the mountainside said to be the final resting place of Noah's Ark, the idea that we're going back to sort of biblical times, at least with ISIS, I think the point that you're making actually is the really important one, is that it's not so much that this pre-modern religious zeal that drives ISIS is really what the story's about, so much as the pre-modern absence of state power and the vacuum that ISIS is filling in Iraq and Syria.
Undoubtedly, and it so happened to be one of the most horrific groups we can have, and I think it is giving everyone pause, and I think it's going to help probably reshuffle some of the alliances that have formed in the past decade.
Well, we can only hope, though, that that a number of prominent Islamic scholars and leaders step forth and start condemning these people.
I agree. I think that's essential. I think it's essential. I mean, they privately disagree with them, and sometimes very, very modestly. But it really has to be a very clear position against the intolerance of these groups. Intolerance is too kind a word, obviously, in terms of what they're doing in threatening those who disagree with them, whether it's in religious beliefs or political views.
Earl Shibli Talhami, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Shibli Talhami, who is the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland. He has served as an advisor to the U.S. mission to the UN and more recently served on the Iraq Study Group as a member of the Strategic Environment Working Group. He's currently a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and previously served on the Board of Directors of Human Rights Watch and the United States Institute of Peace. He's the author of The Stakes, America in the Middle East, and his latest book is The World Through Arab Eyes, Arab Public Opinion and the Reshaping of the Middle East. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back and go to the United Kingdom to talk about ceremonies commemorating the 100th anniversary of the outbreak of World War I.
Senators don't pass legislation, and marches alone can't bring integration. When human respect is disintegrating, this whole crazy world is just too frustrating. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Christopher Clark, who's Professor of Modern European History and a fellow at St. Catherine's College at Cambridge University in the UK. He is the author of Iron Kingdom, The Rise and Downfall of Prussia, 1600 to 1947. And his latest book is The Sleepwalkers, How Europe Went to War in 1914. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christopher Clark.
Hello, nice to be here.
And I think we can clearly trace today's conflicts in Gaza, Lebanon, and Syria, and not to mention Iraq, which we've just been discussing, to the events unleashed by the assassination in Sarajevo on the 20th of June in 1914. And You're in the United Kingdom, where there have been obviously a lot of focus on the 100th anniversary of the outbreak of World War One, much less so here. Let's begin with that that suggestion that the tottering Ottoman Empire that eventually collapsed, and of course the secret Sykes-Picot Treaty, are up for grabs, are they not, as we speak?
Yes, I mean, one of the most remarkable pieces of symbolic spin politics, if you like, that IS or ISIS have indulged in has been the posting up of posters stating that this is the end of Sykes-Picot. They're referring to the agreement struck between the British and the French over a sort of partition of the Middle East during the First World War. So, I mean, they have, I don't think they're very historically intelligent or historically aware people, but they have enough knowledge to know that the troubles of the Middle East stem in part from the from this terrible conflict of 1914 to 1918.
So the ceremonies that took place last week in Belgium with King Philippe, David Cameron, the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, and Prince Harry, it strikes me as a little odd in a way to have members of the royal family, because wasn't it, after all, a spat within the same royal family, that the Kaiser felt that his English cousins were looking down their noses at him and he was going to teach them something?
Yes, I mean, people sometimes ask, you know, how could Europe go to war when all these monarchs were related to each other? And I always feel that people who ask this question have obviously never been at a family Christmas. But, I think that the fact that these relationships were so thick and fast, and in fact they were, people were cousins with each other, several times over. The family trees had almost fused by 1914. But that, of course, did absolutely nothing to make war less likely, because despite the close relationship in terms of their shared DNA, these individuals were, in fact, no longer the key policymakers. They're no longer the people who had real power. And they had become, as it were, symbols of a national, of their respective national political cultures.
So, what was it in the British press? Was there any sort of snarky remarks about the young royals and that going back to the sort of indifference and insularity of royal families, translating a family squabble into what? How many millions died?
17 million. As many as 16.
16 million.
Military deaths, and 21 million if you count the civilian deaths, caused by disease, war-related disease and so on. No, there hasn't been any sarcastic commentary on the monarchy. I mean, the British monarchy has had an extraordinary, extraordinarily adventurous and rather successful history. You know, they had a difficult time in the 19th century when the royal consort, the husband of Queen Victoria, was indeed a German, freshly brought in from Germany to sort of replenish the intellectual credentials of the family. That was Prince Albert. He brought Christmas trees and all kinds of other Germanic paraphernalia to Britain. And there was a time when he was thought to be sort of an alien implant, but even he was, managed to endear himself to the nation. And the royal family today, I think, is really a very successful symbol of what Britishness is. And so there's not very little, really, in the way of critical commentary on, especially in particular on the Queen, who's really, sort of almost sacred figure for the British public. What there has been is an interesting debate about whether we should be celebrating the First World War. The predominant mood of popular remembrance of this conflict, which of course took many, many young British lives, was one of a sort of, it was a rather mournful sense of the futility of this conflict, and the needlessness of it. And I think that's changed in the last few months. Since the beginning of the anniversary year, there have been lots of voices, particularly from the currently governing Tory party, the Conservative Party, led by the former Education Secretary Michael Gove and various other figures, who've been saying, hang on a moment, we shouldn't be mourning this war. We should be celebrating our victory. We should be proud of what we achieved. It's good that we fought this war. We fought it against a dreadful enemy, and we should be proud of that. So there's been an attempt to sort of, in the spirit of what used to be called jingoism, to reinvent the war or to revive patriotic pride in that conflict. And this is quite an unusual thing, because if you look at France and Germany, There's been no trace of that in either of those two countries. France remains within the sort of tradition of mourning this war as a national cataclysm. And the Germans were initially rather shy of doing anything for the anniversary at all, the German government at least, and has only rather slowly and tentatively come out into organizing very sotto voce, low-key events. But this sort of mood of patriotism is really, as far as I can see, fairly much a British matter.
And before we get into the comparisons between the entangling alliances that dragged the big powers into war back then 100 years ago to today's geopolitical landscape, where the crises in Ukraine and the disputes over small islands in the northeastern Pacific could drag the US and China and Russia into a wider war, we already have had, in a way, a kind of revisiting history in a way with what happened in the 1990s over the former Yugoslavia, with the Serbs of pre-World War I Serbia in the form of Slobodan Milosevic. I think, at least in terms of understanding what drove that kind of Serbian nationalism. Interestingly enough, Russia had to sit that one out. They were very upset about their brethren being bombed by the U.S., and that's a part of the seething grudge that Putin has. You know, a lot of the guys that he's unleashed in eastern Ukraine fought as GRU mercenaries in the Balkans, and then went, of course, also fought in Chechnya, and now they've found another war. So are there any analogies there that you think that at least in terms of Serbian nationalism?
Well, I think you've already hinted at one very interesting one, which is this sense in Russia of having suffered repeated humiliations. And as you just said, you know, the Russians certainly felt, in particular, I'm thinking now of the Russians pre-1914, they were very angry about something we call the Bosnian annexation crisis, the decision by Austria-Hungary to formally to annex an area of land that Austria-Hungary already occupied, but to formally absorb it into its political territory, an area called Bosnia-Herzegovina, which, of course, was in the news again in the 1990s because it was one of the hot zones of the conflict over the dissolution of Yugoslavia. And the Russians felt after 1908 and 1909 that they'd been cheated, sort of ripped off by the West. Well, not by the West, by Austria-Hungary, I'm sorry to say, by Austria-Hungary with the backing of Germany. And there was a sense, you know, we won't let ourselves be humiliated again. And Putin clearly looks back on the wars of the 1990s and Russia's relative helplessness in the face of NATO action. Even, of course, the Russians are now forgetting how slow NATO was to respond to the Bosnian War and how long the West waited before it finally took action to prevent the bloodshed and the killing. And, of course, he also overlooks the fact that it was actually a very successful action. But there's another interesting analogy with the pre-1914 situation, and that's the fact that, you know, shortly before the First World War broke out, there was a war in Libya. There was a war by the Italians on Libya in 1911. And this was an extraordinary thing. It was completely unprovoked. The Italians simply wanted to acquire a colony in northern Africa. And this is the first war that saw aerial bombardments. This had never been seen before. Bombs which were thrown from planes, they were fairly primitive bombs. You had to grip them. The pilot had to grip them between his knees and prime them by hand by screwing the fuse into the back end of these things and then aim them with his hand while somehow not losing control over his machine at the troops below. But, of course, they had a terrifying effect on the troops, and dirigible balloons, you know, airships were used by the Italians with racks of up to 250 of these bombs, which could be thrown down. So the 1911 war in Libya was the first war to see aerial bombardment. And, of course, that was an important milestone to 1914 because that war on Libya, which was then an Ottoman possession, flashed a green light to the Balkan states to wage their respective wars on the Ottoman Empire, and who started this sort of chain of conflicts which wound up with the First World War. Well, fast forward 100 years to 2011, and hey presto, we're bombing Libya again. This time it's NATO, it's a sort of Western coalition, bombing the Gaddafi regime, you know, with very different reasons and with the support of a UN resolution and so on. So all perfectly legitimate in those terms. But nevertheless, we find once again that there's an important signal here, because, you know, Vladimir Putin, at a very famous press conference in 2011, expressed his disgust with the way in which the West had taken control of the situation in Libya, and clearly regarded this as a further humiliation after the Yugoslav wars of Russia before the eyes of the world. So there are parallels. Parallels about power politics, about narratives of humiliation and of national pride and prestige. These remind us that there are modes of behavior and forms of emotion in politics, in international politics, which haven't changed since 1914. I don't myself see very much evidence that we've become much more politically intelligent as a species than we were in 1914.
So is it possible that we could stumble into a war in the Pacific over some piles of rocks that are uninhabited?
Appalling as that sounds, I think it is possible. I mean, if you think of the situation with Ukraine today, one of the reasons why, despite, you know, the horrors of the Malaysian Airlines jet being shot down and so on, despite all of that, one of the reasons why the situation isn't escalating or hasn't escalated faster than it might have is that actually the architecture of communication between Russia and Western Europe and the United States is actually pretty robust. The conversation can take place on many different levels. It's not just about Vladimir Putin. It's happening at many different levels. There's the G8, there's the European Council, there's the OSCE, the KSCE, the CSCE, various organizations which involve Russia in conversations with other states, other Western states. But if you compare that with the situation in East Asia, where we have, you know, islands over which there are very serious conflicts, there's a pattern of rhetorical escalation, increasingly radical demands, overflights by military aircraft, dangerous talk by public figures and politicians. In a situation, however, where there is virtually no communicative architecture, no security organizations which can mediate between the different interests. I mean, North Korea is one of the most isolated regimes that there's ever been in world history. The conversation between Beijing, Seoul, and Tokyo isn't exactly easy. It's a very fragile, very brittle conversation with not very many channels, as it were, operating in parallel. So I think, yes, what we have in the West Pacific is effectively a combination of a 21st century societies, hypermodern societies with, you know, social media and hypermodern infrastructures and communicative technology and so on, but as it were welded onto an effectively 19th century system of security arrangements.
Well, Christopher Clark, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Christopher Clark, who's Professor of Modern European History and a Fellow at St. Catherine's College at Cambridge University in the UK. He's the author of Iron Kingdom, The Rise and Downfall of Prussia, 1600 to 1947. And his latest book is The Sleepwalkers, How Europe Went to War in 1914. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.